We have breaking news just coming in to the Russ Finkelstein newsroom. The Supreme Court has just handed down its ruling on the Donald Trump immunity case. Despite the fact that basically every president in American history has used their power of office to commit countless crimes, it's now official. If the president of the United States commits a crime in their official capacity as president, they will be immune from prosecution. Again, I'm not sure it changes much, practically speaking, because the job of president involves the commission of crimes. Regardless, there's a lot of people lighting their hair on fire now about this. And following his abysmal performance at Thursday's debate, Joe Biden is now in a position to do the funniest thing possible. I'm reading here from Justice Sotomayor's dissent. She's talking here about the powers of the presidency in the wake of this ruling. Quote, "When he uses his official power in any way under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune. Immune. Immune." So, yeah, it might be a crime, actually, for me on this podcast to say that Joe Biden should order SEAL Team 6 to kill Donald Trump, which is why I would never say that on this podcast. I would never say that Joe Biden should order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate Donald Trump because it would be hilarious. I wouldn't say that. That would be crazy, and I could potentially be charged with a crime for saying that. But if Joe Biden were to do that, according to this ruling, it seems like he'd be protected. So I'm not sure that's something that's being considered now by the president's strategists after what happened on Thursday, but food for thought. So now that we've gotten that breaking news out of the way, welcome back. I'm Russ Finkelstein, your host of the New Yorker Political Scene, where we break down what is being discussed on the New Yorker's podcast, The Political Scene, hosted by Evan Osnos, Jane Mayer, and Susan Glasser. We have basically the sequel to last week's episode, which was essentially the pregame show for Thursday's presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. If you listened last week, you'll know that I was incredibly excited about this debate. I don't have much faith lately that American politics will produce things that are productive or hopeful for the American people or for the world. But I did think that Thursday's debate had all of the makings of a titillating spectacle. And boy, was I not disappointed. I enjoyed every second of this debate. If you watched or you watched clips, you know that Joe Biden was sundowning. The Democrats had a complete meltdown. They saw their political future and the future of the country flashing before their eyes. This was perhaps the best night of news television since election night 2016 when Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton. It was that level spectacle, and for me, a TV news producer and fan, really can't hope for more dramatic content than this. Maybe my favorite part of the whole evening was actually CNN's post-debate show. After the debate, they cut to John King, who's sort of the polling guy. He's the guy at the magic wall when the results come in. He's sort of tabulating up all the results. He's usually not in the business of doing much analysis. As soon as they cut away from the debate, they went to John King, and he held up his cell phone, and he said, my phone is blowing up. Democrats, powerful Democrats, elected members of the Senate and the House and governors are texting me and calling me and saying that there's a contingency of them that are going to go to the White House tomorrow and demand that President Biden step aside and let someone else run in his place. Van Jones basically cried on national TV. He sounded like he just checked Joe Biden into hospice care. He said, I love Joe Biden. Joe Biden is a good man, and it breaks my heart, but he is simply not up to the task, or something to that effect. This really seemed like it was a funeral for the Biden campaign. It seemed like they weren't going to be able to turn things around. Anderson Cooper interviewed Kamala Harris.
Some within your own party are wondering if President Biden should even step aside. What do you say to that?
Listen, first of all, what we saw tonight is the president making a very clear contrast with Donald Trump on all of the issues that matter to the American people.
If you haven't seen it, you might want to just pause this show, go pull up YouTube, watch the entire thing. It's really something to behold. Anderson Cooper went at her and said, you know, what is your response to this abysmal performance from Joe Biden? And Kamala Harris tried to spin it. It's some of the most surreal shit you'll hear from an American office holder. It's like Soviet Union style level of spin and delusion, which made for really great television. The favorite podcast of Democratic millennials, Pod Save America, on Friday they tweeted, obviously that debate was a fucking disaster. We have to beat Donald Trump. We have to have a nominee who can do that. And since we haven't had the conversation yet, it would be absurd if Democrats didn't at least have a serious discussion about whether Joe Biden, who's a wonderful human being and has been a great president, is up for the job. So that was Friday. By Saturday, the Pod Johns had done a 180. This, by the way, is from one of the Johns, John Favreau. Just gonna say it again, I love Joe Biden. He saved democracy in 2020. His legislative record is arguably the most consequential of any modern president, including my former boss. He had been a Obama staffer. And right now, there's nothing more important than defeating Donald Trump in this election. It seems like Biden and his team think that despite what we all saw on Thursday night, the president is still the best candidate to do that. Like we've said on the pod, that's their call, and if they stick with it, we'll certainly keep doing everything humanly possible to help reelect the president, including encouraging hundreds of thousands of Vote Save America volunteers who helped elect Biden in 2020 to again donate their time and money to winning in November. Stakes are too high to do anything else. There you have it. Let's hear from the eggheads of the New Yorker political scene, get their reactions to this debate, and imagine what it all says about this crazy little place we call America.
What we saw last night, I just think the elephant's out of the room.
Yeah.
Okay? For a long time, they have said to us, it's an attack that's ageist. We all saw it right in front of us. Now we have to discuss it. It's right there.
Okay, so it's been right there in front of us, anyone who's paying attention, for years now. As a cable news producer, I regularly have to watch Joe Biden's speeches and different public appearances. I could have told you going back the last 2 or 3 years that the guy can't get through like 10 minutes of public speaking without having a moment that's easily snipped and clipped. But the very hosts of this podcast, the New Yorker political scene, as recently as last week, were saying that the reason why people think Joe Biden is senile is because Fox News and other right-wing outlets are selectively and deceptively editing him. Here they are just last week.
The right has been going nuts with out-of-context clips and the like of Biden, but they've also set up this weird expectations game for the debate, haven't they? Where, you know, if Biden can clear the threshold of not being a dementia-ridden, you know, senile old guy, that maybe he wins by benefit of Trump's strategy to demean and diminish him.
How did that go for him, Susan?
There could be an instant in this debate that goes viral in some ways in bad faith. Look, we are right now, just in the last couple of weeks, the Republican National Committee has been circulating some especially egregiously edited clips of Biden intended to project the idea that he is unfit to be president. And I think there is going to be a flurry of those things.
Deep fakes, AI, all of this kind of thing that can really sort of tamper with reality.
Deep fakes and AI tampering with reality. Could you imagine it? Could you imagine such a thing that they would manipulate us into thinking that Joe Biden is senile? He's in cognitive decline. Can you imagine how dangerous it would be if we were led to believe that because of things we were told? These are especially egregious comments coming from Evan Osnos in particular, but also Susan Glasser. Her husband, Peter Baker, is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. You might have heard him on their daily podcast this morning talking about all of this reporting he's done about top Democrats and their concerns that Joe Biden might lose to Donald Trump and all the strategizing they're doing to try to prevent that from happening. But Evan Osnos in particular is widely considered to be a sort of Bidenologist. He wrote a biography about Joe Biden. Earlier this year, he wrote a long profile about Joe Biden for The New Yorker. And I was heartened to see that in the wake of the debate, that reporting was actually taken to task by Semaphore. I'm reading from an article in Semaphore by Max Tanney. The headline is, quote, totally different. Biden's biographers and defenders reckon with the debate. Quote, why did anyone think Joe Biden was ready for a 90-minute presidential debate? One reason is that a small handful of journalists, with left-leaning sympathies but very credible records, have interviewed him and those close to him in the White House and returned with reports that while he's definitely older, he's still pretty sharp and in charge. Two of the most prominent are Biden biographers Evan Osnos and Franklin Foyer. I spoke to them Sunday as they reconciled their own portrayals with the faltering 81-year-old they saw on national television. In his deeply reported New Yorker article, Osnos detailed Biden on the precipice of his final campaign, the definition of an elder statesman steeling himself for a rematch with an emboldened Donald Trump. But his one sit-down with Biden in January, the White House declined his invitation for a second, he described an older Biden in command of his faculties. His voice is thin and clotted, and his gestures have slowed, but in our conversation, his mind seemed unchanged. He never bungled a name or a date. The Biden I spoke with in January was a very different Biden from the one we saw on stage Thursday night, Osnos said on Sunday. Osnos said that following Thursday's contest, he'd concluded that Biden, quote, clearly has good days and bad days and wretched days. What we saw was not the kind of performance that anyone would want from a candidate, end quote. And he said he made no apologies for his journalism. For that New Yorker piece, he'd spoken at length with Biden advisors and confidants who raved about his ability to do the job despite his age. Quote, I don't think I would do anything differently, Osnos said. Besides Osnos' piece, for which he interviewed Joe Biden in January, he's been writing for The New Yorker, recording episodes of The New Yorker political scene, and he's also a talking head on CNN, where he regularly gives his opinions and analysis about Biden, and is supposed to have sources inside the White House and with people who are close to Biden giving him information of all the goings-on. If Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser, whose husband Peter Baker did not have reporting that indicated that Joe Biden was in mental decline, they are derelict of their duties. They should be shamed. They should be scolded. A large part of the reason why Democrats and the American public are so shocked Joe Biden would give such an abysmal performance during a debate. The fact that everyone was so surprised by that is a reflection of what a terrible job people like Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser have been doing. They're paid hundreds of thousands of dollars and heralded as some of the best, well-sourced journalists in this country, and yet they themselves were caught off guard by something that I, a lowly segment producer, it's worth mentioning that I used to be a segment producer at CNN, and I would work regularly with Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser. I've spoken with both of them frequently over the last 4 or 5 years. And again, they get paid shitloads more than me, and are generally thought of as enlightened journalists who have the inside track on what's happening inside the White House. Me, a lowly segment producer, I get relegated to tasks like, for example, watching a Joe Biden speech and cutting sound bites for Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser to respond to. And guess what? It's been abundantly clear to me for years now that Joe Biden is in cognitive decline, and that the fact that people recognize that should not be blamed on selective or deceptive editing. These are the people that would have you believe in 2019 and 2020 that Joe Biden stumbled because he had a stutter. And they would poo-poo or dismiss as a conspiracy theory any notion that the reason why he was stumbling was because he was in some sort of cognitive decline. So it's rich for them to have wagged their finger as recently as a week ago at right-wing media and social media platforms for deceiving the American people about Joe Biden. And I'm glad that Semaphore published this article by Max Tanney, sort of calling into question Osnos' past reporting. But I hope that when the history books are written about this chapter, it's not just Joe Biden and his family and those in his inner circle that convinced him that he should still run for president that are shamed. So-called journalists like Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer should get their fair share of the blame as well.
We all know that age is the inescapable factor for Biden. It's not like it's just coming up now. But there was an element of some kind of a curtain being pulled back that Democrats who prefer to focus, understandably in many respects, on Donald Trump's lies and misrepresentations, for this hour and a half at least, they could not avoid the evidence of their own standard bearers, you know, very obvious diminution.
Where were you, Susan? Where were you and your husband, Peter Baker, months ago when the Democrats were deciding basically to cancel primaries, to not hold competitive primaries. Think about this. The Democrats could have held competitive primaries and they could have had debates. Joe Biden could have debated fellow Democrats months ago when it would have been much easier for the party to replace him at the top of the ticket instead of heading into the convention with Biden having already secured a bunch of the delegates.
I mean, it was almost a sort of visceral physical reaction, I think, that people
yes.
had just literally to the very first impression of seeing him. There's something just almost biological, just that we register when we see somebody who looked as he did when he walked out from the wings, looking in effect kind of frozen and sort of tremulous.
So what this makes me wonder is, like, if you're Evan Osnos, you interview Joe Biden one time in January for an article that you write in The New Yorker, and then between January, February, March, April, May, June, for 5 months, you go on TV and you go on this podcast and you talk about Joe Biden and you talk about what he must be thinking and how he strategizes and what he thinks about himself and what he thinks about politics and the people that he surrounds himself with. And you act like you have the inside track on this guy who's the president of the United States, and that is your employable skill. Are you not watching the speeches that I am watching? Are you not going to his events? Like, are you not attending his campaign events? When Evan Osnos is giving his opinion and analysis of Joe Biden, is he just going off of the conversation he had with him one time in January? This is a totally honest question. So I'm just really curious how much of Joe Biden Evan Osnos is being exposed to, being that he's the fucking Biden guy.
I remember one of the conclusions that I reached earlier this year about him is how personal this is for him, for Biden. You know, that it wasn't just that Trump tried to steal the election. He tried to steal it from Joe Biden. And over, people have said about Biden over the years, and he says it himself, that politics is not for him local. He always shoots that idea down. Politics is personal. It's personal. And that is, in its way, a painful fact, because it means that the decision about why to do this, how to do this, is for him, I think, inextricable from the strategic
question. So interesting.
It actually is kind of interesting. But to me, the interesting part is the fact that the Democratic Party, which has the support of around half of the country, is essentially being held captive by an 81-year-old man who just wants to run for re-election and just thinks that that's a good idea. And as a result, there's apparently nothing that can be done to relinquish the power from him. If Joe Biden was your grandpa, there would be some recourse to, like, go to a court or something and take the keys away so he couldn't drive a car anymore. But the Democratic Party apparently has no recourse to take the presidential nomination away from the guy because he's currently the president and he wants to run for re-election. That to me is funny.
I do wonder if the failure in this debate is a reflection of what it would mean to be president. Does it mean that he would fail as a second-term president? Is this a litmus test to measure whether, you know, he's capable or not capable?
I've never been president, so it's hard to say, but it doesn't seem like Joe Biden can consistently string two sentences together in a coherent way. So I don't know, Jane. I think if being president means having to articulate ideas and express yourself coherently with words, then maybe his performance at the debate is an indication that he's not really up to the task of being president. But maybe the task of being president just involves sort of like, but maybe the task of being president really is just like having milk and cookies and letting a bunch of aides and secretaries and people in your administration sort of run things. It has become a Republican talking point that Joe Biden isn't really in charge of the country. But wouldn't it actually be terrifying if Joe Biden was having like consequential conversations, for example, with like Benjamin Netanyahu or Vladimir Putin, or fuck, leaders of Congress for that matter, and he's expressing himself the way he expressed himself at that debate? Like, wouldn't that be terrifying? I hope for all of our sake that he's not actually in charge of the country.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you can make up the scenarios and who would come and see him. It's interesting to try to analyze who in the Democratic world has the power to go speak to him and talk to him about this incredibly sensitive issue. I mean, if I were listing who could conceivably do it, it would be Nancy Pelosi. It would be Chuck Schumer. Yeah. It would be Hakeem Jeffries. If they went to him and said, we're going to lose every race across the country if you don't enable somebody else to be at the top of the ticket here, that might mean something to him. He is a Democrat who wants Democrats to win. I imagine if some of the big donors from Hollywood came and said,
Jeffrey Katzenberg,
we've been with you completely, but I can't keep people in line behind you at this point. Those things would matter.
I just love that the guy who lost $1 billion on Quibi is somehow one of like four people that Joe Biden would listen to about this.
You know, I was thinking, what would you do if you were his campaign chairman or something?
I would quit. Easy question. I'd fucking quit.
I mean, they could potentially try to put him out there where he will be having a press conference. If he could show himself to be in command and energetic and quick, they might be able to engineer some appearances that would make this disappear into the rearview mirror a little.
So it's been a few days since they recorded this episode of The Political Scene, but it does seem like they're kind of trying to do that. I saw that they had Biden today giving a response to the Supreme Court ruling. So I guess expect to see more of that. I hope they keep it up for my own morbid curiosity. In the long run, though, Joe Biden's only going to get older, so I'm not sure how they're going to reverse the aging process and convince people that somehow Joe Biden is aging backwards. But it should make for a very interesting fall.
The campaign, by the way, is a lot of folks are thinking about the John Fetterman debate, which he had after his stroke against Mehmet Oz. Look, the fact they're invoking a stroke victim is not a good sign, but that is a case where he had a terrible debate and went on to win the race. So that's if you're actually curious about what they're saying to one another, that's the one they're talking about.
Side note here about John Fetterman. He was on Bill Maher a few weeks ago, and he basically said that having a stroke and then waking up from the stroke made him less progressive and allowed him to feel more comfortable vehemently defending Israel. So maybe look for that as another side effect of whatever Biden's going through.
Let's just say that the party machinery operates in some ways that are opaque to us now, but somehow result in a replacement. Is there a viable Democratic candidate in your view? And did anyone else like me watch Kamala Harris last night late on CNN after the debate and think, wow, she just made the case for Joe Biden a million times more coherently and persuasively than Joe Biden made the case for himself?
So I'm going to play you now a chunk of that interview that she's talking about where Anderson Cooper interviewed Kamala Harris on CNN. Susan Glasser there was saying that she thought Kamala Harris did a great job making Biden's case for him on TV. What I thought when I was watching that interview was, I can't believe Anderson Cooper is actually going at Kamala Harris that way. And I can't believe Kamala Harris is denying the reality that we've all just witnessed before our eyes. It kind of felt like when you see the translations of those North Korean newscasters or something. It's like, here's a person that is just completely detached from reality. But judge for yourself.
Some within your own party are wondering if President Biden should even step aside. What do you say to that?
Listen, first of all, what we saw tonight is the president making a very clear contrast with Donald Trump on all of the issues that matter to the American people. Yes, there was a slow start, but it was a strong finish. And what became very clear through the course of the night is that Joe Biden is fighting on behalf of the American people, on substance, on policy, on performance. Joe Biden is extraordinarily strong. And
but I'm sorry, on substance and policy and performance tonight, I mean, the president's performance tonight clearly was disappointing for his supporters. CNN is reporting Democratic lawmakers watching the debate were worried about the president's performance. One said it was a disaster. Another called it a train wreck. Those are Democrats especially worried that Biden did not punch back on Trump's lies.
Listen, people can debate on style points, but ultimately this election and who is the president of the United States has to be about substance.
He was a very different person on the stage 4 years ago when you debated him. You must, I mean, that's certainly true, is it not?
Anderson, the point has to be performance in terms of what a president does. A president who incites an insurrection against the Capitol. No, but I got the point that you're making about a 1.5-hour debate tonight. I'm talking about 3.5 years of performance in work that has been historic.
But is that the man who we saw on the stage tonight, is that the person you see in meetings every day?
The person that you saw on the debate stage that has, for the last 3.5 years, up until today, performed in a way that has been about whether it be in the Oval Office, negotiating bipartisan deals so that we have an infrastructure, a real infrastructure plan where we're putting trillions of dollars on the streets of America.
Okay, so you get the idea. I intentionally left that soundbite quite long, longer than I normally would have. To be fair to Kamala Harris, and to be fair to Susan Glasser, who is saying she found this to be a really compelling argument that Kamala Harris was making on Joe Biden's behalf. Again, I'm not getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to do political analysis for The New Yorker and for CNN, and I'm not married to The New York Times' chief White House correspondent. But what I heard there was someone who's trying to spin the most disastrous debate performance probably in American history. And Anderson Cooper, to his credit, trying to hold her to account. But as I've said before, that's why I'm just some asshole with the podcast. And Susan Glasser is Susan Glasser.
A Democrat told me last night, the problem is we are a hollow party. Not meaning that we don't have a bench, meaning that we don't have a powerful structure at the Senate. We don't have mandarins who are able to actually go and say, here is what we do next. And this is, Jane, you know better than anybody, a function of how we fund our politics, that it's really the politician, it's the person who has the power. It's the party is an appendage.
And it's the funders. I mean, honestly, exactly. It's the people, a handful of people who were billionaires have an incredible amount of power. And I don't know whether what role they're playing behind the scenes here.
This is by far my favorite part of the podcast. It might be my favorite part of the podcast since I've been doing my own podcast about the podcast. And that's because it really confirms what's been my layperson suspicion about American politics and the Democratic Party in particular. As Evan Osnos explains, one of the party insiders telling him, the Democratic Party is basically just a hollow machine. It's a structure that exists primarily to raise money to fund campaigns, and is therefore controlled by the biggest donors to the party. And the party itself doesn't really have mechanisms in place to steer the ship or to adhere to any specific ideology. And it's just reassuring to hear these three who are as establishment as you can get in the media, basically recognizing that a handful of incredibly wealthy people control the most important political institutions in the country, and the Democratic Party in particular. Even though I have a lot of negative things to say about these three, I am grateful that when push comes to shove, sometimes a glimmer of light shines in into the otherwise dark prism that is the New Yorker political scene. It's gratifying, and it makes me feel slightly less insane.
If he does stay in and is defeated by Trump, I think that there will be tremendous amount of blame placed on the Democratic Party's leaders for having and allowed this to happen.
And there's blame to be placed on the three of you as well. You guys are so handsomely compensated when so many great journalists are out of work. You're celebrated with awards, you're revered by media institutions, you're elevated as public intellectuals. You share much of the blame for this mess the Democratic Party and the country finds itself in now. And that's why I'm here, that's why I'm doing this podcast, at least for now. Thus concludes another episode of the New Yorker political scene. Thanks again for joining me. This show will actually be going on a short hiatus. My wife and I will be on vacation in California, seeing some family and friends, and going on a little road trip. But I will be back in a few weeks, and until then, if you're enjoying this podcast, let me know, either by leaving it a positive review, sharing it, telling your friends and family about it, or, if you're so compelled, drop me a message. I would love your feedback. I'd also really like to find a way to start having guests come on to help me deride these guys. And also, if you're a journalist, we could discuss your work or whatever you want to share with our listeners. I swear it'll be fun. Maybe it'd be a poor career move, but who cares, right? Journalism is a sinking ship. So let's fling our poo. Fling our duty at these guys, right? Maybe it's a bad idea. Maybe I'll regret this. Anyway, thanks again.